This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's going to be an exciting one tonight. It is episode 432. Yes, it's going to be exciting tonight. We're moving another database server, and I've just kind of been tangentially on the edges of this, so I'm basically just around in case something goes wrong. That's my job. They were going to try to move this the day before my colonoscopy. And that's when I had to wander in and go, I'm having a colonoscopy today. So I'm going to be unavailable. So then they pushed it a week. And then one of our database administrators, her dad was having some fairly serious physical problems. So, you know, then we stopped that. And then it looked like he might still be having some physical problems, but he appears to be okay. So tonight's the night. So I'm just kind of on standby, but I will obviously hop on to my stuff at home and watch with them as we go through, you know, this, that, and the other. And if we error off, then we'll figure out where we erred off and, you know, try to restart things and hope everything balances out and everybody's happy and et cetera, et cetera. So it should be exciting. But, you know, we've moved enough databases now that it's usually fine. And our database administrators are just extremely diligent. And the people who have watched over making the changes in the connection strings and all that kind of stuff, they're very diligent. And, you know, typically it goes okay, but you just don't know until you try it. So this way, if something goes wrong, you know, I'll probably just head back in. And then we've got all night to get things fixed. So tomorrow, I'm going back to the VA with my dad, try to turn in all of our paperwork to see if we can get any benefits from the VA. And mostly it would be nice if they would just help with new hearing aids for him, because he's really wanting new hearing aids, and they will pay for them. So, you know, when you got that, you got that. Everything else is puttering along. We're trying to kind of settle into a new normal with Mom and with Dad, and kind of trying to figure out all of that stuff. It's just really interesting. We've been trying to get Dad down there to see Mom multiple times during the week, and it's just fascinating, because, you know, a lot of the mechanisms and that he's used to being able to use with Mom, he can't use those with Mom, because in her brain 30 seconds ago she was home and she was just fine, because she has dementia. And in his brain, he still thinks that he should be able to just use reason and logic to talk to her. So that leads to some very interesting conversations. Especially when I've been down there to listen. I get reports from my daughter as well when she takes him down there. So, and we'll see. It's, you know, for a while there, it looked like Mom just wasn't going to eat. And then, of course, that would hasten things. And now, then she started eating a little bit here and there. And so, it's very interesting. Talked to my brother over the 4th of July. Tried to get him up to speed on what's going on. And, you know, what the expectations are. And, of course, there's no way to pin down exactly what's happening when at this point, because you just never know how long someone is going to linger. because there's days when she seems alert, she just still has the dementia, and then there's other days when she just sleeps a lot. So it's fascinating. Anyway, so that's good. As far as writing goes, book 6 is wrapped at this point, although I think I still have one more review that's outstanding. I like to get 10 reviews, and as part of the whole beta reading process, if people wrap up and leave me a review on Amazon, then as part of that process, I send them an autographed, personalized copy of the production version, and so I've sent out 9 of those at this point. Well, I have 9 of those allocated at this point. I have to deliver 2 more on Sunday. But once I get those delivered, that's that. So I have 1 more. I'm just waiting to see if that floats up. I may ping the readers 1 more time and say, you know, I still have 1 more. And I've been delivering the free copies that I normally deliver and taking that. And of course, I've been going back and starting to read now again what I've written so far in book 7. I am doing the core dump in book 7. But then again, I did a core dump on this podcast of most of that stuff. But as far as my opinion as to what's going on with gender relationships, I do the core dump in the book from a couple of different perspectives with characters, so it comes across a little more harsh than I did in my podcast, but that's okay too. So it's fun. It's fun. It's fun. It's fun. I'm still in the woods on this book. I've got some kind of ideas where things are going, but I'm not sure where they're all ending up yet. And I know where I need to be in the next book, and so I'm trying to get those dots to line up so that I can write through into the next book. So it's fascinating. It's just fascinating. But I believe we are over 1 million words now on this series. And which means that, you know, we'll be crowding 1.15 million words by the time I finish. Well, wait. No. Hold up. We will be at 1 million words if the current book I'm working on turns out to be 140,000 words, which it probably will. That's the target. So after I finish writing book 7, we'll be at 1 million words. So, and we're cranking close. I'm at 85,000 words, so I'm within 60,000 words of having put down 1 million words so far in this series. So that's fun. That's a little goal. And there's more to come. If I could just figure out what's supposed to happen. Anyways, okay. So I came across a phrase that I had heard before. I came across it again, and I just found it fascinating that the phrase is still applicable today, because I had been hearing the phrase for a while, but I just came across I was watching an AI discussion meeting at one of these conferences that had been recorded, and, you know, very sharp man who was there who actually had been applying deep learning to the stock market, and they had done so well in terms of year-over-year gains and being able just to outpace and outproduce the market in terms of financial gains, that they were charging a flat fee of 5% and 40-some-odd percent of any gains, and people were happy to pay it because they were just making so much money in this guy's fund. So, sharp guy, accomplished a lot, made a lot of money, for whatever that means. I think it was in that conference session that he mentioned this phrase, and I had heard this phrase before, and once I heard it again, I thought, that would probably make a good podcast. I should have looked it up, since there's been 431 podcasts. I really should have looked it up, but I do not recall at this point that I have ever talked about this. I may have mentioned it, but the phrase is the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in natural sciences. And honestly, we can extend that application now to the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in artificial intelligence. Because one of these sessions that I was watching, they mentioned in this session that in fact the early neural networks, the problem was is you couldn't be many layers deep. You would just end up with noise. And then some mathematicians said, oh, hey, we can run these formulas, and that's how you could get around that. And so they ran it. This idea that mathematics is unreasonably effective in our existence has been around for a while. The article I'm going to be quoting from was actually first written and published in 1960. And that's what surprised me when I heard this artificial intelligence conference talking about this, because apparently, even still now, and I went and looked it up on Wiki, and I'll grant you that Wiki is not always completely accurate, but even when I looked it up on Wiki, there were some people that had suggested some possibilities for it, but one guy in particular said, well, it might be this, but yeah, that still doesn't explain this. So what do we mean by the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics? Well, the guy started off in this article. He started off in this article quoting Bertrand Russell in his book/article, The Study of Mathematics, that mathematics, rightly viewed, possesses not only truth, but supreme beauty, cold and austere, like that of a sculpture, without appeal to any of our weaker nature, without the gorgeous trappings of paintings or music, yet sublimely pure, and capable of stern perfection, such as can only the greatest art can show. The true spirit of delight, the exaltation, the sense of being more than man, which is the touchstone of highest excellence, is to be found in mathematics as surely as poetry. Okay, so, you know, whatever. Obviously, some mathematicians, you know, thinking math is so great doesn't really impress us that much, because pretty much anybody in their field should think what they do is pretty great, you know, etc. But the guy started off this article with a story, and he said there is a story about two friends who were classmates in high school talking about their jobs. One of them became a statistician and was working on population trends. He showed a reprint to his former classmate. The reprint started, as usual, with a Gaussian distribution, and the statistician explained to his former classmate the meaning of the symbols for the actual population, for the average population, and so on. So he's showing how that in many, 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 many places, when you look at distributions, those distributions tend to form into this beautiful little bell curve, which I think is what they're talking about when they're talking about a Gaussian distribution. That is a mathematical thing. It doesn't necessarily mean it has to occur in nature, but it does. So, because of that, his classmate was a bit incredulous and was not quite sure whether the statistician was pulling his legs. Quote, how do you know that? How do you know that these populations will just fit into this Gaussian distribution so beautifully? Oh, said the statistician, that is pi. I'm not sure how that fits in, but I know what pi is. What's that? Oh, it's the ratio of the circumference of the circle to its diameter. At which point the classmate said, well, now you are pushing the joke too far. Surely the population has nothing to do with the circumference of the circle. And what has happened over the last many years is these wonderful quote-unquote coincidences, the wonderful applications of things that you wouldn't think go together, and yet they do. The guy went on in this article to talk about the role of mathematics in physical theory, the success of them. He said one of the examples he quoted was, he said the first example is the oft-quoted one of planetary motion. So the laws of falling bodies became rather well established as the results of physical experiments carried out principally in Italy. So Galileo determines that gravity works on all objects simultaneously the same when he drops things, but of course he couldn't do anything about air resistance and those things taking them out. But anyway, so he develops this theory through just observation, and then he maps into that a mathematical formula. He says, the guy in the article says, so let's just recapitulate our thesis in this example. First, the law, particularly since this second derivative is in it. I don't know enough about mathematics to get all this, but they made some sort of a formula. There was this thing called a second derivative in it, which is simple only to the mathematician and not to common sense or to non-mathematically minded freshmen. And it's a conditional law, very limited scope. It explains nothing about the Earth, which attracts Galileo's rocks, or about the circular form of the moon's orbit, or about the planets, or the sun, etc., etc., etc. But this formula that was developed out of this, that seemed to fit the data, ended up being very accurate when there didn't really seem to be a reason that it should be. He says the second example of that is ordinary elementary quantum mechanics. He says this originated when Max Born noticed that some of the rules of computation given by Heisenberg were formally identical with the rules of computation with matrices long established by mathematicians. And so, you know, these guys are over here thinking about the physical world, making some notes, making some formulas, and then they look at these formulas and go, well, that looks like this very abstract concept in mathematics over here. And so then they go over there and take that. And lo and behold, it works. And in fact, it works well enough that we now have a theory of reality that is heavily based on mathematics. String theory is all mathematics. And it makes certain predictions, etc., etc., etc. But without mathematics, you wouldn't get there. And I think of Einstein sitting in his room staring at the wall, doing thought experiments and then writing out little formulas in mathematics. And yet, those are extremely useful in the real world and get proved out by experiments far after the formulas were created. And they send the clocks up in the planes and it's like, lo and behold, there it is. And Einstein comes up with this just because he's fiddling around with some math. Seems unreasonably effective. And this is what the guy in the article is talking about. So he goes through this, that, and the other, etc., etc., etc. Because I'm almost home, blah, 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 blah. He does say that as we move forward, and I've been reading other places, that as we move forward, that there's things in biology now that can be explained with mathematics, and there's things, and it just goes on and on. But it doesn't necessarily seem like it should. The original author said, "Let me end on a more cheerful note. The miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. We should be grateful for it and hope that it will remain valid in the future research and that it will extend, for better or for worse, to our pleasure, even though perhaps to our bafflement in wide branches of learning." You know what? I need to take this... Wait, where is my phone? I need to actually take this phone call, so one moment, I'm going to pause here. Okay, so checked my mail and talked to the hospice nurse, and I need to wrap this up. Anyways, so the wiki article on this basically said the same thing, that there is this deep connection between science and mathematics. And I think this is quoting from his article or someone's article when they said, "It is difficult to avoid the impression that a miracle confronts us here." One moment, I'm backing into my garage. Okay, "It is difficult to avoid the impression that a miracle confronts us here, quite comparable in its striking nature to the miracle that the human mind can string 1,000 arguments together without getting itself into contradictions, or to the 2 miracles of the laws of nature and of human mind's capacity to divine them." And as I said, there are people that, like Richard Hamming, H-A-M-M-I-N-G, an applied mathematician and a founder of computer science, reflected on this man's article in 1980, mulling over 4 partial explanations, but he concluded that the 4 explanations were unsatisfactory. So, you know, they've tried. There's a whole bunch of quotes from different people at the end of this wiki article. "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible," Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein's, "How can it be that mathematics, being after all a product of human thought, which is independent of experience, is so admirably appropriate to the objects of reality? In my opinion, the answer to this question briefly is this. As far as the laws of mathematics refer to reality, they are not certain. And as far as they are certain, they do not refer to reality." I don't know what he means. So, you know, there was another guy, Israel Gelfand. "There is only one thing which is unreasonable more than the unreasonable effective of mathematics in physics, and that is the unreasonable ineffectiveness of mathematics in biology," which that may be changing a little bit now as well. So the last quote is here. "We should stop acting as if our goal is to author extremely elegant theories and instead embrace complexity and make use of the best ally we have, the reasonable effectiveness of data." You know, there's all kinds of stuff going on, but it's really interesting. What really started me on all this, as I said, was when that phrase came up, I thought, well, you're done by that right now? And if you're not done by it and you're still thinking about how is this working out so well, then who knows? Who knows? Maybe it gets back to that idea of the 3 waves of science. You know, in the first wave, you don't know much. You just have your observations. You look around at the world and you can make little clay animals and you think, well, that's not that hard. And then when you get deeper into science and you begin to apprehend some of the complexity, then God seems too powerful and too amazing. And so then you just push back and you say, well, this all just had to happen. And then there's little hints, and who knows, maybe mathematics is one of those. That if you just really stop and think about it, that you've got these really interesting connections between higher levels of math all of a sudden helping to explain and predict things in the natural world where nobody saw the connection that was there until they got deeper and deeper into it. It's fascinating to watch all that roll out. You know, who knows? Maybe somebody will explain it someday. All I know that at this point there are a lot of pursuits in science, including AI, that are benefiting tremendously from what it seems should be an esoteric discipline that is deeply disconnected from the real world, and yet it is not. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.